As we are coming to the Feast of Pentecost, our attention has been on that. You are probably studying and reading about that, and anybody preparing for the Feast of Pentecost will eventually end up in Acts 2, if not start there in Acts 2. And as you go through Acts 2, and you read some of the other surrounding verses, you very soon begin to realize that there is one person whose actions were pretty obvious. He seemed to be a central figure in a lot of these things. And from the very beginning of the church, you see this man being used effectively by God. His name was Peter. When I say effectively, I mean, you read these things and you marvel. Any person who has ever had to get up and speak and give sermons reads Acts 2 and then reads Acts 3 and think, wow, you know, to be able just to stand up on the spur of the moment, moved, obviously, by God, and give sermons like that that would result in thousands of people not only learning things, but being hit in the heart. Now, you don't attribute all of that to just somebody speaking, because you understand it's God has to be working in the hearer as well to be moved and to understand it. But nevertheless, you look at someone like that and think that is somebody being used very effectively by God to move people. That's just in Acts 2. In the very next chapter in Acts 3, we read about Peter coming across as they were going to the temple, a crippled man, and looking at that man, just commanding him to rise, and this man jumps up and he is healed. And of course, God used that example and that miracle to grab the attention of many other people. And then Peter gave another powerful sermon in Acts 3. In Acts 4, he and a couple of others are arrested, and they're brought before the Sanhedrin. And even before that religious governing body, Peter again gives a very strong and powerful defense for what they are doing. And then after that is over, and they boldly state, you know, who are we supposed to obey? You are God. And they walk out of there, and the first thing they do is go and report this to the church that is assembled, and they all start praying to God for help. You know, God had just helped them. But the first thing they did was go to God and recognize his power and his authority, and they just beseech God to stay with them and keep working with them in ways like that. And then in Acts 5, there's Peter again. You have Ananias and Sapphira who come into the church, and this is the first hint that not everybody is on the same track, because Ananias and Sapphira come in and they lie, and it's Peter who discerns that they are lying. And he confronts them, and of course they fall down dead, and this miracle happens there. And it says great fear came upon the church. I guess so. That would get people's attention. And as you go through the book of Acts, you see others certainly doing things, but Peter is used mightily. One of the most mighty places, again, is in Acts chapter 10, where he is given this vision from God about this sheep with all these animals. And God confronts him with a situation that was a learning situation, and Peter finally realizes God's telling him, you don't call people common or unclean, and God sends him to Cornelius. And then Peter is the one who has the first contact by realizing the Gentiles are being called by God. And another miracle takes place there too. Well, if all we had was the book of Acts, we would be pretty impressed with this man. We would just look at them and say, wow, you know, what a guy. But if that's all we had, we would be drawing the wrong conclusion. If all we had was the book of Acts, we would not know that he wasn't always this way. We would not know that all credit should go to God. We would not understand the powerful working of God's Spirit in Peter's life, and we would not understand what it took for him to be trained and to learn to be used by God in that way and to be positioned. Peter went through a period of intense training and preparation and experiences that were very powerful and learning experiences. And what Peter did have going for him, though, is that he was willing to be trained. There was a willing heart in spite of some very difficult circumstances. And his training continued long after the book of Acts, too. Long after he received God's Spirit, his training would go on, just like ours does. Our training goes on. We have often said that we too are in training. We are in training to be kings and priests in the kingdom of God. And we are training to show the way of God to other people in this life before we even get to the kingdom of God. It was Peter himself who wrote later to all of us, you are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, his own special people, that you may proclaim the praises of him who has called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. But before Peter could proclaim the praises of God, he had things to learn. And we who are supposed to be proclaiming, whether it's by a quiet example or whether it's by our words to explain things to people when asked, we too go through times of training. When you look at what Peter wrote in his two books, a lot of that is just basically training instruction. It's telling God's people, here's how to behave, here's how to think, here's how to act. And I cannot help but conclude that what Peter wrote decades later to the church, he reflected back on his life and what he had been through and things that he had learned. I also wonder, though, when we look at our lives and see ourselves in Peter a little bit. We're not all the same personalities. We're all different. But there are things that are common to people that we can learn from. And his life story in the Gospels not only tells us about something about how to respond to situations and lessons learned, it also tells us about how Christ works to train us, how Christ will work with a human being, and how sometimes he will relate with and teach and train all of us. And we have a lot to learn just from the life of Peter, a lot to learn about God's Spirit even. We can learn some great lessons, and among them, you're going to see, it seems like one of the lessons Peter learned over and over was how to be corrected, you know, how to recover when you make mistakes. And I don't know about you, but, I do too. I know about you. I know about all of us in that way. We make enough mistakes in life that we have to learn how to make those course corrections in life, don't we? One of my favorite cartoons, I was sad the day it stopped being published, was Calvin and Hobbes. Calvin and Hobbes always had some great life lessons. And one of these with Calvin and Hobbes, Calvin had a little table set up on the sidewalk where he was selling something. You know, most kids have lemonade stands, not Calvin. He had, the cartoon is his dad stopping by to see how things are going. And Calvin has a big poster set up on his table, and it says, Swift Kicks in the Backside, $100. His dad says, business isn't going very well, is it? And Calvin says, no, and I can't figure out why. There are so many people who need one. Well, you know, I've stopped by that stand many times in life, and there are many times I wish I could have gotten by for just $100 of lessons learned, you know. Most lessons in life cost us a whole lot more than $100. And we all, you know, have many times in life when we need a swift kick in the backside. Well, you know, on the one hand, we learn lessons in life. We learn spiritual lessons. And those lessons are priceless. And it's part of our training. And as we go through some things Peter learned, let's think about which one of those would he say, oh, I wish I would have never gone through that one. Every single thing he went through, he learned from, and it was priceless, and it was part of making him what he needed to be. So we're going to take a look at some of Peter's experiences and draw some of these lessons today. I don't know if you have a map in the back of your Bible that's handy, but just to give you a little bit of interest here, he came from Galilee, an area named Bethsaida. And if you see the Sea of Galilee in northern Israel, you'll notice on the north shore of that lake is Bethsaida. It's a little fishing village. And it was actually a Roman garrison at that time. It is a beautiful area. It's a great climate, 3 or 4 miles from a more famous little town called Capernaum. I had the chance in 1972 to stand right on the ruins in Capernaum of the temple. And you're standing there and you're saying, this is where Christ was. This is where he preached in this synagogue, not the temple, but a synagogue right there. Mark 1 tells us that Peter was married and he lived in a house near the synagogue. Luke 5 and verse 3 tells us that he had a ship as well as a house. He was a fisherman. There's the implication of having a house and a fishing boat is that he was not a poor person. Doesn't mean that he was rich, but he worked his trade as a fisherman there. We know he was bilingual. He wrote the book of the books of 1 and 2 Peter in Greek. And Matthew 4:15 says the region was known as Galilee of the Gentiles. It was Galilee of the Gentiles, and it must have been a Greek-speaking area because that was common. And other scholars note that it's very probable that Peter knew Aramaic as well as Greek and Hebrew. We don't know which tribe he was from, but geographically, the people of Bethsaida were generally from Naphtali. At that time, though, all the people in the land at that time were called Jews. They were not necessarily all literally Jews. Paul was from Benjamin. Barnabas was from Levi. Anna was from Asher. But they were all, at that time, just called Jews. We don't know what Peter was, but it's possible that he was from the tribe of Naphtali. Now, it's important to note the languages. Because in Acts 4:13, you read this statement when they were brought before the Sanhedrin, and it says, when they saw the boldness of Peter and John and perceived that they were uneducated and untrained men, they marveled. The King James Version is a little more harsh. The King James Version says they were unlearned and ignorant. Well, you can hear that and think, well, they couldn't read and write and tie their shoelaces. No, that's not what it means. Uneducated does not mean that they could not read and write. It means that they had not been trained in the school of the rabbis, the way the scribes were. They had not been trained that way. Peter was educated. Some scholars say that his writings in Greek and his language usage is on a par of that with Paul. And Paul was a very well-educated man. But where had they been trained? The rest of the verse in Acts 4:13 says they realized they had been with Jesus. Well, for 3.5 years they'd been trained. So these were not, they were trying to say, how is it these men can come across with such conviction and expression of truth, and they haven't been trained in the schools of the rabbis? They realized, oh, they've been trained by Jesus Christ, and that was the best training you could get. But their training was going to be far more than just in scholarly areas. Where is it, brethren, that we need our greatest training? Where do we need our greatest training? In John chapter 1, we can see how Peter came in contact with Jesus for the first time. In John 1 and verse 35, we read again the next day, John stood with two of his disciples. This is John the Baptist. One of those disciples, as we will read, was Andrew, who was Peter's brother. John 1:35. And looking at Jesus as he walked, he, John the Baptist, said, behold the Lamb of God. These two disciples, or the two disciples, heard him speak, and they followed Jesus. Then Jesus turned, and seeing them following, said to them, what do you seek? They said to him, Rabbi, which is to say, when translated, teacher, where are you staying? And he said to them, come and see. They came and saw where he was staying and remained with him that day. That was about the 10th hour. One of the two who heard John speak and followed him, Jesus, was Andrew, Simon Peter's brother. He first found his own brother Simon. So he's following Jesus, and then he goes to find his brother. He finds his brother Simon and said to him, we have found the Messiah, which is translated the Christ. So he goes to get his brother. Obviously, if you are convicted all of a sudden, we have found the Christ. Maybe partly it was what John was telling them. Maybe partly it was what they saw. But John told them, behold the Lamb of God. And so they took off and followed Christ, and something convicted them. So he goes to get his brother. Now, Peter must have had some degree of curiosity, because you're going to find out Peter did not have the personality where somebody could just lead him around by twisting his ear. Peter was his own mindset. And so he must have had some degree of curiosity to go with Andrew, because it says in verse 42, he brought him to Jesus. And his introduction to Jesus now is going to be rather startling and thought-provoking. Verse 42, now when Jesus looked at him, he says to Simon, you are Simon the son of Jonah. You shall be called Cephas, which is translated a stone. Simon in Greek was his name, Simeon in Hebrew, Cephas is Aramaic. And it's not really a name, it's more like a title. And he said, I'm going to call you a stone man. Well, that would certainly pique your curiosity, wouldn't it? You go to meet this fellow, the first thing he does is turn around and say, you know, I know what your name is, but I'm going to call you this. Well, Jesus was in the process of calling certain ones of his disciples, and their real training was going to begin very shortly. In John chapter 2, it says, on the third day, there was a wedding at Cana of Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. Now, both Jesus and his disciples were invited to the wedding. And they go, and weddings were a big deal. They were frankly, a lot of fun and celebrating. And immediately, one of the first things they began to be exposed to is a very different situation than what they would have seen were they with John. They were going to see some new ways of thinking and new ways of life. And this is in a contrast. Some of them had been following with John, we read, including Peter's brother. Where was John? Where had he been? What was he like? Well, he'd been out in the desert. He had no wife, no kids, no wine, no steaks. You know, he was not a person who would be inclined to go to the party. First thing that Jesus does is take them to a wedding supper, to a festival. And there's eating and drinking and dancing. And then he performs his first miracle that he ever performs, and that is he turns water into wine. And it's good wine. It's the best. They could not help but think, well, this guy's different. He has a different approach than John had. And in verse 11, we read, "This beginning of signs Jesus did in Cana of Galilee and manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in him." So he was doing things to help them believe in his power. Now, that's a great introduction to somebody. I mean, we might say, who would you rather be trained by? You'd rather be eating locusts and honey or steak and wine and going to wedding parties? But they were also going to find very shortly that there was another side to this as well. In verse 14, he found in the temple those who sold oxen and sheep and doves and the money changers doing business. When he made a whip out of cords, he drove them all out of the temple with the sheep and the oxen and poured out the changers' money and overturned the tables. And he said to those who sold doves, "Take these things away and do not make my father's house a house of merchandise." They saw this man get mad, get angry, makes a makeshift whip and starts driving the animals out and going through overturning tables, you know, driving people out of the temple and just on fire about what they were doing in his father's house. And then, verse 17, his disciples remembered that it was written, "Zeal for your house has eaten me up." They knew their Bibles too. They remembered this psalm. Well, this is one of the first things they see in him as well is the zeal. Now, Peter himself, being a witness to this, was by nature a pretty zealous type of guy. And over the next 3 years, he was going to try at times to copy and to emulate the zeal that he saw in Jesus Christ. But the only problem that we're going to see is that Peter's zeal was often misguided. And there is a great lesson in this. There is a great lesson in this for us to learn. But keep these things in mind. They are seeing things. They're watching and they're observing. This is part of their initial training. We come to John 4. Therefore, verse 1, when the Lord knew that the Pharisees had heard that Jesus made and baptized more disciples than John. Verse 2, though Jesus himself did not baptize, but his disciples. Now, that's sort of interesting. He trained them, even how to do a baptism. We do this today. When somebody is a ministerial trainee, you can go to a lot of baptisms and watch them, but you don't pay a whole lot of attention. Okay, what exactly is said? How exactly do you do it? But he was training them even to do things like how to perform a baptism. He was right there. He was supervising. He got all the credit for it. But he was actually giving them instruction on things great and small. But what follows in this chapter is another tremendous training experience that really begins to overthrow their thinking. It begins to make them rethink whole ways of life they've grown up with. The story in John 4 is that of Christ talking with the Samaritan woman at the well. I'm going to skip the story and go right to the issue about their training. He has this long discourse with this woman at the well, and then in verse 27, at this point his disciples came and they marveled, not at his words. They weren't marveling at anything else. What were they marveling at? That he talked with a woman. You know, of all things to blow you out of the saddle. It goes on to say, yet no one said, "What do you seek?" No one said, why are you talking with her? They were just shocked. Why were they shocked? Because they were just products of their environment. This was the environment they'd grown up in. If they had always accepted what they had always been taught, and, you know, they just could not help but marvel because all the other rabbis at this time would never speak to a woman in public. It was beneath them. But here they see this Messiah who is not living according to typical human codes of everybody else that is around him, what everybody else does. Jesus was teaching them to be concerned about what is right and what is wrong, not about what the custom of the time is. Now, they marveled at that. There was going to be a lot of marveling on their part, on a lot of things. They were marveling at all sorts of things. He was basically showing them an example. You've got to rise above your environment. That environment can be good in many ways, but it can be destructive in many ways. And they were products of that. We need to be aware of that ourselves today, how our cultures influence us. Now, Peter was among those marveling. Later on, a few years later, I've already mentioned this, he was going to be put into a situation where God was going to have him go and talk to some people too that normally he would not have gone and talked to. God was going to use Peter to say, I want you to go and be my instrument to talk to the Gentiles whom I am going to be bringing into the church, and I'm going to be giving them my spirit too. And it's going to upend your way of thinking. And Peter really marveled at that, and it took him a while. But I wonder, when the time came for him to go to Cornelius, did he stop and think about the way Jesus did with this Samaritan woman? Maybe Peter looked back at that and said, you know, I've already learned something from him, that the way we think about things is not always right. Maybe it made it easier for him to rethink his position toward the Gentiles, while some of the other people were struggling a little bit with that. Jesus was training them to see that God's ways are not man's ways. And he did it, as we will examine, he did it in many different ways. Sometimes he did it gradually. Sometimes he just stunned them. Sometimes he taught them. Sometimes he asked them questions and made them answer. Sometimes he took circumstances and taught them immediately about it. Other times he made them go ponder some things. Sometimes he made them stew about some things. Sometimes he would ask them questions and not provide an answer, but make them think it through and learn. Well, God teaches us, and he shows us things. And sometimes God shows us miracles, too. Sometimes he shows us trials, and he corrects us a little bit here and there. And sometimes he encourages us, and sometimes he inspires us. But through it all, we are always be learning, because we will be tested. Life is a test. Let's go back to our story. Let's go to this process of coming into his calling in Mark chapter 1. In Mark 1, there's something we need to learn here and consider. In Mark 1, you know what, Jack? I forgot to turn this on. I may have to give another sermon in front of an audience of nobody this week. Do it at my desk at home. In Mark 1, in verse 16, we read, "And as he walked by the Sea of Galilee, he saw Simon and Andrew his brother casting a net into the sea, for they were fishermen. Jesus said to them, 'Come after me, and I will make you become fishers of men.' And immediately they left their nets and followed him. When he had gone a little further from there, he saw James, the son of Zebedee, and John, his brother, who were in the boat mending their nets. And immediately he called them, and they left their father Zebedee in the boat with the hired servants and went after him." Now you might say, well, what happened? I thought that what we read in John, it said that they went down to find him. But now this says here that he finds them. Is that a discrepancy in the biblical account? Well, the answer is no. Because if you study the context of John 1, we did not go through all the context, but if you go back there and study the context of John 1 and get a map, have a map with you when you look at it, Jesus first met Andrew and Peter in the region east of Jerusalem. It was out toward the Dead Sea, north of the Dead Sea, where they were with John the Baptist. That was a good 50-plus miles from Galilee. And when you read John 1, it says later that Jesus wanted to go to Galilee. And over the next 3 days, they walked up there, and that's where they went to the wedding in Cana. And if you look at your map, Cana is up west of the Sea of Galilee. It's a pretty good ways from where they first met him. So over 3 days, they walked up there. So actually, what we're reading in Mark 1 is the second time that they meet him. He had already been with them. Matthew, Mark, and Luke began their accounts of Christ's ministry in what is called the Galilean period. John gets some background prior to Galilee. And if you have a harmony of the Gospels, it will show this. So what we're reading here in Mark, they had already seen who he was. He had already exposed them to a certain extent of his teachings, but now he calls them, and now they make a commitment to follow him. But there would be tests. He was about to take them into more training. Verse 21, "Then they went into Capernaum, and immediately on the Sabbath he entered into the synagogue and taught, and they were astonished at his teaching." It's funny, it seems like every time you turn around, they're marveling or being astonished. And I suspect that's what it would have been like to walk with Jesus Christ. "They were astonished at his teaching." Why? "For he taught them as one having authority and not as the scribes." Again, they were going to be astonished at a lot of things. Now let's go to Luke and pick up his account. In Luke chapter 5, Luke 5 verse 1, "Now so it was, as the multitude pressed about him to hear the word of God, that he stood by the lake of Gennesaret and saw two boats standing by the lake, but the fishermen had gone from them and were washing their nets. Then he got into one of the boats, which was Simon's, and asked him to put out a little from the land. He sat down and taught the multitudes from the boat. Now when he had stopped speaking, he said to Simon, 'Hey, let's go fish a while. Launch out into the deep and let down your nets for a catch.' But Simon answered," Luke 5:5, "and said to him, 'Master, we have toiled all night and caught nothing. Nevertheless, at your word, I will let down the net.'" Now, this is an interesting way of saying it. The word "nevertheless" doesn't exactly sound like he had a great deal of confidence in what he was going to be doing here. And why would he? And after all, Peter, he's the professional fisherman. He's the one, it's his boat, his nets. He knows when you fish. He knows where the fish are. He knows the habits. And here's a carpenter coming down out of the hills telling him how to go catch his fish. Well, It's also interesting, the word master in verse 5 here, master, that may convey a bit of irony, because the word means commander or supervisor or boss. Why would he call him that? It's almost, you almost get the impression that he's saying, okay, boss, whatever you say. Whatever you say, boss. Maybe that explains why we read what happens next. After they had done this, verse 6, they caught a great number of fish, and their net was breaking. So they signaled to their partners in the other boat to come and help them. And they came and filled both the boats so that they began to sink. When Simon Peter saw it, he fell down at Jesus' knees, saying, depart from me, for I am a sinful man, O Lord. Whoa. Why would he have that kind of reaction? Why wouldn't he just say, wow, you're pretty good. You know, I should have listened. I'm sorry. You know, didn't mean to be sarcastic back then. Why would you fall down at somebody's knees and say, depart from me, I am a sinful man? That is a very strong reaction that he is that he's having here. This is a bit unusual. Well, this was humbling for Peter. It was extremely humbling. And you know what? Humility is a good thing. Humility, in fact, is a requirement. It is a requirement. We will all be tested on our humility frequently. It will be a test of life, and it is a test that we must pass. Stone Man didn't need the carpenter's help, he thought. He was the expert, but something made him realize this is not about fishing. He realized I was disrespecting the Messiah. He had already recognized who he was. He had seen miracles. He had heard. He had already spent time marveling. But isn't it funny how we can get out of marveling? And he was looking at Christ's humanity instead of his divinity. And he was just treating him in a way that he saw his attitude was not a mistake. His attitude was sinful. And he said, I am a sinful man. But you know what? Christ wasn't interested in departing from him. Peter said, depart from me. It's like saying, I'm not worthy. Christ doesn't want to depart from Peter, and he doesn't want to depart from us when we make our mistakes. He wants to help us depart from the mistakes. That's where God wants to do. Christ had no interest in departing from him, but he did have interest in Peter learning. So this is the first time that the stone man finds himself on his knees, finds himself in that way, misjudging what Jesus was doing, what Jesus was telling him to do. One of the best things we can do in life is to be very careful not to judge Christ on the way he leads us. The way he leads his people, the way he leads his church, what he's doing, be very careful not to disbelieve him. Verse 9, for he and all who were with them were astonished at the catch of fish which they had taken, and so also were James and John, the sons of Zebedee, who were partners with Simon. And Jesus said to Simon, do not be afraid. From now on, you will catch men. He was telling them something here. So when they brought their boats to land, they forsook all and followed him. It was going to happen, but it was going to be a while. Now, as you read through from here, you read the rest of the Gospels, you see the disciples continue to witness things. They see all sorts of things. They see Christ casting out demons. They see people being healed. They hear the Sermon on the Mount shortly, profound things. They see also not just what Christ is doing, they're seeing the reaction of people toward Christ, and especially the people that they had formerly respected. The scribes, the Pharisees, the religious leaders, they began to see how the way of God was in conflict with the way of these religious leaders. And that was probably somewhat disillusioning to them when you realize people aren't the way they appear to be. Well, then came another test, another type of test. And this was a hard one. And this was a doctrinal test. In John chapter 6, there is a long discourse here about a very deep subject that was really hard for a lot of people to wrap their minds around. It was something contrary to their understanding, to their past teaching, and it was going to be a doctrinal test when Jesus was telling them, you have to eat my flesh and drink my blood. And he was telling them about something spiritual that they couldn't get past some of this physical analogy and symbolism, and it was really difficult. I'm not going to go through that whole thing, but in verse 60, we read, therefore, many of his disciples, when they heard this, said, this is a hard thing. Who can understand it? When Jesus knew in himself that his disciples murmured about this, he said to them, does this offend you? And the answer is, yes, it did. It offended a lot of people. They stumbled over it. And in verse 64, he said, but there are some of you who do not believe. For Jesus knew from the beginning who they were who did not believe and who would betray him. Now, did the people know it? They probably didn't even know it themselves. Did the disciples were they all aware of it? No, Jesus knew it. He knew it from the beginning. He knew something's going to come along, and it's going to reveal who among these followers really believe. It's going to reveal what they are, where they are. There comes a time when God will find it out. There comes a time when we have to find it out. There comes a time when these things are revealed. Verse 66, from that time, many of his disciples went back and walked with him no more. And then there comes a time when we have to declare ourselves. There are situations in life that make us declare which way we're going to go. And that's not easy. And in verse 67, then Jesus said to the 12, now they all have a test. He wants an answer from them. Do you also want to go away? Then Simon Peter answered him, Lord, to whom shall we go? You have the words of eternal life. Also, we have come to believe and know that you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. Now, Peter answered for all of them. He was the spokesman who came forward. He passed this test. He passed it. Now, it's interesting. Peter does not give an explanation to everything that Jesus has been talking about. Peter doesn't say, well, I know what you're talking about. I understand it all. It doesn't say that he understood everything. He got to the core of the issue, though. He said, we know. We know who you are. There is nowhere else to go. And we have come to believe. There was an issue of faith here. We have come to believe and know that you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. That's what we know. And we're going to follow you. Maybe they also knew, if we don't understand this teaching, we can come to know it. But the real issue is, will we follow you? They've proven where he was. Now, there was a point when God brought all of us, and maybe our parents or grandparents, and he threw some new doctrinal understanding at us that a lot of people get offended over. And a lot of people will be interested in their point where they say, no, I'm not going to walk with you this way anymore. There was a time when it might have been hard to get past some of the doctrinal understanding. And there is a time, even if you grow up your whole life with it, that you have to say, okay, is this what I believe? Will I go away or will I follow you? It's a tough thing. It's not easy. But we have to come to that test. Many people have stumbled there. And that's part of our understanding, too. We have to have right understanding of what God teaches. But then we also have to have right understanding about character. And that's another thing that Peter would find out. They saw many things. They saw miracles. They saw him feed 5,000 people and then 3,000. There are wonderful things that are associated with following Jesus Christ. You've got to say, there are wonderful things. But there are also some tests, too. Let's go to Matthew chapter 14. It's one thing to witness a test and to admire and to say, boy, that's great. It's one thing to sit in the stands and talk about the basketball players and how well they're doing or how badly they're doing. And then that's another thing to be thrown out there on the court and say, okay, now you got the ball. How well will we do? In Matthew 14, verse 22, immediately Jesus made his disciples get into the boat and go before him to the other side while he sent the multitudes away. And when he had sent the multitudes away, he went up on a mountain by himself to pray. When evening had come, he was alone there. But the boat was now in the middle of the sea, tossed by the waves, and the wind was contrary. So sometimes Jesus Christ and God the Father, they're on their throne, and we're in the boat. In the middle of the lake, the wind is contrary, and things are just rollicking right along in life. Tossed by the waves. Now, in the fourth watch of the night, Jesus went to them walking on the sea. And when the disciples saw him walking on the sea, they were troubled, saying, it is a ghost, and they cried out for fear. But immediately Jesus spoke to them, saying, be of good cheer. It is I. Do not be afraid. But Peter answered and said, and notice, who sets the standard for the test? Who's the one who sets what the test is going to be? Let me ask you this. Have you ever made your own test in life? Have you ever made choices that got you to buy? And you look back and you say, well, I guess this was of my own making. Peter says, Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you on the water. Peter stretched himself as far as he could and said, this is big. Jesus says, okay, come on. You know, what's big to us is not big to God. So he said, come. Peter, he called Peter's bluff, if you will. Not that Peter was bluffing, but I mean, to say, okay, Peter's saying, I want to test you. If it is you, I want to test you. He says, come on. So Peter then has really no choice but to step out. And he does well. Peter is passing the test. When Peter had come down out of the boat, he walked on water. That, you got to admit, that should make a big statement. But when he saw that the wind was boisterous, he was afraid and beginning to sink. He cried out, Lord, save me. That shows you something about the human mind. We can be right in the middle of doing something right, the most powerful thing that's ever happened to you in your life. And you could be walking on the right way, and then you just get distracted. Start looking around, and what did he see? What did he look at? He saw the wind. This is a real bad wind. And the first thing you do, you look at circumstances, and circumstances begin to affect your faith. You ever been tested that way? Ever see Peter in yourself? How many times have we been there? Immediately, Jesus stretched out his hand and caught him, and all he does is say one little thing. Oh, you of little faith, why did you doubt? All he did was ask Peter a little question. He didn't chew him out. He didn't yell at him. He didn't, all he did was ask him a question, and he puts Peter in the boat. And I just imagine Peter crawling up into a corner and wrapping a blanket around him and trying to dry off and thinking, why did I doubt? Peter had to answer the question. Christ didn't demand an answer of him. He just said, why did you doubt? You know, there are a lot of things in life that after we go through the test, that's when we need to sit down and revisit it. That's when we need to answer the questions, okay? And Peter had to answer a question. That was part of him learning. Doubt is serious. Doubt is really serious in life, and we need to grow in that area. We face that trial. Sometimes when we get ourselves in binds, and only God can get us out, maybe Peter realized, human courage, human impulsiveness, human strength will eventually fail you. The human thinking will fail you. But you know, brethren, sometimes it's the one who fails that grows the most. The one who fails who grows. You know, remember, some of our failings are in front of other people. They were all in the boat, and Peter failed in front of everybody. And maybe everybody heard what Christ told him. But you know, nobody else got out of the boat either. And so maybe they were all sitting there thinking about, why did I doubt too? Maybe that question was for everybody. At least Peter got out of the boat. Why did I not believe? We have these things in life, and sometimes it's through failings that we grow. Peter was undoubtedly a fine man. He was a strong man. But human strength is not enough. It's just not enough. And so Christ was working on his understanding, and he was working on his nature. He was working on his character, and Peter was going to be growing. We come to chapter 16, and there is a remarkable event here. Remarkable. Matthew 16, verse 13. When Jesus came into the region of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, like every time he asked him something, that's a test, pop quiz, Jesus was prone to pop quizzes. You can only imagine in 3.5 years how many questions he asked them. They go, oh, boy, here we go. So Jesus asked them, saying, who do men say that I, the Son of Man, am? So they said, some say John the Baptist, some Elijah, others Jeremiah, or one of the prophets. Then he said, now here it gets personal. Who do you say that I am? And once again, who comes up? Who raises his hand? Who is out there? A natural-born leader. He steps forward, Simon Peter. And he answered and said, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. That was a wonderful answer. That answer made it obvious to Christ that Peter was growing. Peter was learning. That had to be pleasing God. Now he's going to roll Peter a little bit further down the... He's going to roll the stone a little bit further down the path. Jesus answered and said to him, blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah. You know what? Flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. Now you think about that. How would you take that? You're sitting there and Jesus Christ tells you something. You know what? You are blessed. And this doesn't come from flesh and blood. God the Father is revealing this to you. I used to get letters every month or two. And I learned very quickly, when you get a letter and says, you open it up and says, God has revealed something to me that the whole church needs to hear. Think, oh boy, here we go. A lot of people who are self-proclaimed vessels of God's deliverance. And you'd read it, if you do what I say, the whole church will be saved. And if you don't do what God has revealed to me, God is going to cast you into the lake of fire. This is your only chance. I am the witness of God. We get these letters. And we've always gotten these letters. This is potentially pretty heady stuff. He goes on in verse 18, I say to you also that you are Peter. You're a Petros, this pebble. And on this rock, Petra, meaning himself, I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. And I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven. This was new understanding. This is the first time Christ ever talks about a church being built. He's telling them something brand new. I'm going to build a church, and you are going to be fundamentally involved with this, and you're going to have authority so much that if you bind something on earth, it'll be bound in heaven and so on. And he wasn't just talking to Peter. He was talking to all of them about this calling. How do you handle that as a human being? Now, you could handle it well. You could handle it well by being humbled by that and say, "What? How did we ever end up here? What a blessing it is to be a part of God's work. This is a special calling. This is a. I'm overwhelmed by this responsibility." On the other hand, this could go to somebody's head real easily. It's a little heavy to be told, God, the Father, is working with you. I'm going to build a church, and you're going to be right there. You're going to have authority. You know, the issue of authority was going to be a big one. There's nothing wrong with authority. God has authority, and he delegates a lot of authority to us. When we get married, we are given authority. When we have children, we're given authority. Even when we have property to take care of. You know, he told Adam and Eve, you're supposed to dress and keep this garden that I've given you. We have responsibilities. We all have to use authority. And when authority is used correctly, it is one of the greatest blessings in life to a society. But when it is used incorrectly, it's one of the biggest curses to a society. Peter was later going to have authority in the church to use very powerfully, but he had to learn it right. And he was about to learn something. He was going to learn a lesson that was going to come swiftly and painfully. So he tells them all this. In verse 21, then he takes them a little further. From that time, Jesus began to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things from the elders and chief priests and scribes and be killed and be raised again the third day. So now he's telling them more things they needed to know. But look at verse 22. Then Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. What happens in a person's mind that moves them from one place to a spot where they think they can correct the Messiah? Saying, far be it from you, Lord, this shall not happen to you. There's almost a little bit of sense that he's saying, you know, I'm not going to let this happen. Don't worry about it. I'm not going to let this happen to you. In verse 23, but he turned and said to Peter, get behind me, Satan. You are an offense to me, for you are not mindful of the things of God, but the things of men. Christ said, I'm trying to take you a little further down the road, and you are blocking me. Now, we often remember this part about get behind me, Satan. That's pretty powerful. But when we read the rest, Christ was basically saying, forget it. I can't even get through anything when you're in this attitude. You are not mindful of the things of God. I wonder at times if we have gotten ourselves in positions as individuals or even as a church where God says, I can't take you any further until we get out of this attitude, until we change our approach, until we change our thinking. Sometimes we stand still until we learn the things we need to learn. Then Jesus said to his disciples, if anyone desires to come after me, let him deny himself. That's not easy. That goes against our humanity. And take up his cross. That's not easy. And follow me. That's not easy. That requires God's Spirit. For whoever desires to save his life will lose it. Whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. What is a man profited if he gains the whole world and loses his own soul? It's either, Christ said, look, it's either self-denial or self-will. And Peter, you have gotten into self-will. Christ was ready to show them more, but he had to take them back to basics. You read something like this, and you think, wow, could I take that kind of correction? Could I take that kind of correction if Christ said that to me? Can you imagine how Peter felt? But, you know, Christ wasn't concerned about his feelings. He was concerned about his life. Peter's life depended on this. Their lives depended on this. Was understanding that they really needed. This was strong correction. This is about as strong as you can ever read in the Bible of anybody being corrected personally. But you know what? Strong correction makes for strong people, too. They can take it. They can take it. And Peter and the disciples took it. This was a big test. This was a big test. Sometimes we only progress as far as we have learned, and we have to push it further. If we don't learn, we don't grow. And so here was Christ, and in one moment, he is telling Peter a statement that is so tremendous. Peter, God is working with you. Peter runs off in the wrong direction with that, takes it upon himself then to say, well, I'll start the binding and loosing right now. I'll just unbind what Christ said. That's not going to happen to you. And then the next thing Christ is saying to him is, Satan is working with you. You know, Peter's bravado, Peter's courage. And Peter's take charge attitude is only good if it's combined with humility and faith and obedience. So Peter was eager, and Peter was growing, but he still needed time. You know, Christ didn't throw him away after this. Christ didn't discard him. He kept working with him. In fact, the very next chapter contains something that had to be really encouraging. It was the transfiguration. That had to be very uplifting to Peter after this previous event. And, you know, there's a lesson in this. God will faithfully work with us. We come to Luke chapter 22. Luke 22. It's the Passover. Jesus tells them that he's going to be betrayed. In fact, he says the hand of the betrayer is with me on the table, right here. And they began to question among themselves which of them it was who would do this thing. 24, but there was also rivalry among them as to which of them should be considered the greatest. And so this is the famous account where he instructs them, actually for the third time in their training, over 3.5 years, the third time this had come up, about how the training of this world is to exercise authority over people and exercise lordship, but it could not be that way among them. They had to be servants. And then he tells them in verses 29 and 30 that he's going to bestow on them a kingdom and they're going to rule over the tribes of Israel. So again, he was encouraging them. But then we come to verse 31. And the Lord said, Simon, Simon, indeed, Satan has asked for you that he may sift you as wheat. Wow. What does that mean? Satan has asked for you. We're not told here. I'm not sure. The image of Job comes to mind where Satan asked for Job, you know, and God let Satan sift Job a little bit. That would be pretty eye-opening. It makes you wonder, doesn't it? How often does Satan ask for us that he may sift us? Well, you know, life will certainly sift us from time to time. It can be done for good. Sifting was done back then where they would take grain in a basket and throw it up in the air, and the wind would then blow the chaff away, and the good grain would fall back down. It was too heavy, and it would fall down. You know, sometimes we are sifted in life, and it helps us blow the chaff out of our lives. But this is not an easy thing to do. Verse 32, he said, but I have prayed for you that your faith should not fail. As a human, you will fail, Peter. You will fail, but this faith that comes from God, I'm praying that that will not fail. And when you have returned to me, strengthen your brethren. Strengthen your brethren. The King James says, when you are converted, when you're turned around, when you are turned around and strengthen your brother, when you come to your senses, take the lessons of life and use it to help others. So he tells Peter this. And guess what Peter's reaction is? Peter thinks, I already have. I'm there already. I've got this one. Verse 33, Peter said to him, Lord, I am ready to go with you, both to prison and to death. Christ might have said, you're not listening. Peter says, I'm ready to go with you. I'll go to prison, I'll die. And he said to him, I tell you, Peter, you don't understand yourself. You don't get it. The rooster will not crow this day before you will deny me 3 times that you know me. Peter could not have been grasping that. He would not have thought, I don't have that in me. I won't go that way. You know, let's go back in time. I'll just do it in your memory. When Peter, earlier that evening at the washing, when Christ came to him, he said, you're not going to wash my feet. And Christ said, if I don't wash you, you have no part with me. He was saying, in all of us, we've got to be washed clean. We have to be washed clean. And Peter was learning some things here. We come to chapter 18 of John. John 18, as we follow in this evening's events. John 18 and verse 4. John 18, 4. They're in the Garden of Gethsemane. Jesus, therefore, knowing that all things would come upon him, went forward and said to them, whom are you seeking? They answered him, Jesus of Nazareth. Jesus said to them, I am he. And Judas, who betrayed him, also stood with them. Then when he said to them, I am he, they drew back and fell to the ground. Just at his word, they were just knocked down. A few more things are said. Then verse 10, then Simon Peter, having a sword, drew it and struck the high priest's servant and cut off his right ear. And he probably wasn't aiming for his ear. You know, he just takes this sword out, and he's going to hack at this servant. The servant's name was Malchus. Then Jesus said to Peter, put your sword into the sheath. Shall I not drink of the cup which my Father has given me? He'd been through this already. Peter had still not learned the lesson. The explanations had been given. Seems like Peter might have had a bit of a temper, and he certainly had his own way of reasoning. And he didn't stop to think, look, If Christ can just say something and they fall down, he doesn't need me with my sword. He doesn't. That's not what he needs. I've often wondered, I wonder what Malchus thought about Peter. You know, Peter made a big mistake, but he learned from it. But sometimes our mistakes affect other people too. Sometimes we cut off other people's ears when we make our mistakes. That's why we need to be quick learners. Matthew 26, verse 52. Jesus said to him, "Put your sword in its place, for all who take the sword will perish by the sword." It's a human way of dealing with things, and it's a wrong way of dealing with things. It's the way that Christianity has dealt with things for 2,000 years, is with the sword instead of by God's Spirit. Verse 53, "Do you think I cannot now pray to my Father, and he will provide me with more than 12 legions of angels? How then could the Scriptures be fulfilled that it must happen thus?" He's telling Peter, you're getting in the way of the Scripture, trying to be fulfilled. "In that hour, Jesus said to the multitudes, 'Have you come out as against a robber with swords and clubs to take me? I sat daily with you, teaching in the temple, and you did not seize me. But all this was done that the Scriptures of the prophets might be fulfilled.'" Notice the last part. "Then all the disciples forsook him and fled." All of them forsook him and fled. "And those who had laid hold of Jesus led him away to Caiaphas, the high priest, where the scribes and the elders were assembled. But Peter followed him at a distance to the high priest's courtyard. And he went in and sat with the servants to see the end." Here's the man who just a few hours earlier said, "I'll go with you to prison or to the death." And he's sneaking around, sitting with the servants, hiding out, actually, as we will find. There must have been a lot going on in Peter's mind. What was he thinking there from a distance? Here was the stone man, eager, brave, impulsive, confident, aggressive, man of action, and yet at the same time unstable because of his impulsiveness, and sometimes weak, and sometimes given to extremes, and even capable of being more cowardly than he thought of himself being. These 3.5 years have been very revealing to Peter. And it wasn't just revealing about doctrine and teaching. It was self-revealing. It was a time of being revealed about what he was and wasn't. And probably he marveled at a lot of that, too, as much as he marveled at Christ. And undoubtedly, he wasn't as sure of himself now. In verse 69, Peter sat outside in the courtyard, and a servant girl came to him saying, "You also were with Jesus of Galilee." But he cried before them all, saying, "I don't know what you're saying." And when he had gone out the gateway, another girl saw him and said to those who were there, "This fellow also was with Jesus of Nazareth." And again he denied with an oath. You ever have something slip out you worked real hard over years to overcome, and then all of a sudden, you know, that word comes out. Talk about stress, what stress will make you do. "And after a while, those who stood by came to him and said to Peter, 'Surely you are also one of them, because your speech betrays you.' And then he began to curse and swear, saying, 'I do not know the man,' and immediately a rooster crowed, and Peter remembered the word of Jesus who had said to him, 'Before the rooster crows, you will deny me 3 times. And he went out and wept bitterly." I feel sorry for Peter reading this. This is the lowest point in his life. After all this training and teaching, he'd come to the lowest point. But this was a turning point. This was a turning point. You ever had a turning point on something? It's something that was a turning point in life. Every element of human strength, every element of human ego had been knocked out of him. And he went out and just wept bitterly. This is as low as you get. This is as low as it goes. Go to John 21. John 21, after Jesus is resurrected, spends time during those 40 days afterwards with the disciples, teaching them further. There comes a time one day in verse 15 when it says, "When they had eaten breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, 'Simon, son of Jonah, do you love me more than these?' He said to him, 'Yes, Lord, you know that I love you.'" Jesus could have said, "Oh, yeah, like you showed me the other night." He could have been sarcastic. He could have been cutting and biting, but that's not Christ. Christ loves us. He cares for us. He's not interested in getting back at us. He was helping Peter take it another step further. And so he didn't say to him anything like that. He said, "Feed my lambs." He said to him again a second time, "Simon, son of Jonah, do you love me?" He said to him, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." He said to him, "Tend my sheep." He said to him the third time. Have you ever been in a situation like that? I mean, I don't know if a husband or wife has ever sat down with each other in a serious thought and said, "Do you love me? Yes. Do you love me? Yes. Do you really?" After a while, you think, why? Why are you asking me this? Why is it this way? Do you love me? Peter was grieved. Peter was grieved because he said to him the third time, do you love me? And he said to him, Lord, you know all things. Wow, this is a little different Peter. In a few weeks before, he would say, Lord, this isn't going to happen to you. Far be it from me to let this happen. No, he finally said, Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you. Jesus said to him, feed my sheep. Feed my sheep. He doesn't address him here as Peter or Cephas, stone man. He addresses him as Simon. Back to Simon. Simon can mean hearer. And maybe Peter was hearing him better now. Verse 18, most assuredly I say to you, when you were younger, you girded yourself and walked where you wished, but when you are old, you will stretch out your hands, and another will gird you and carry you where you do not wish. This he spoke, signifying by what death he would glorify God. Essentially, same death Christ went through. And tradition has it that Peter was crucified. And when he had spoken this, he said to him, follow me. That's what he started out Peter's calling with 3.5 years earlier, when he called them and said, follow me, and they laid down their nets and followed him. And now he says, follow me, but Peter's following him now 3.5 years more mature. 3.5 years on some very dramatic events taking place in his life. Was he finished Peter's training? No. Are we ever finished with our training? Don't think so. In fact, almost immediately, Peter, turning around, saw the disciple whom Jesus loved following, who had leaned on his breast at the supper and said, Lord, who is the one who betrays you? Peter, seeing him, said to Jesus, but Lord, what about this man? And Jesus said to him, if I will that he remain till I come, what is that to you? You follow me. Don't get distracted. Be centered, Peter, on what you need to do. Follow me. He wasn't through with his training. Later, Paul would correct Peter in the letter to the Galatians about his hypocrisy. Peter had slipped into mistreatment of others and had influenced others even. But Peter learned from it. Let's conclude with 1 Peter chapter 3. 1 Peter 3 is written some decades later. The Peter that we see in the book of Acts, from the day of Pentecost, is a very different Peter than we see in the Gospels. This was a man who had learned a lot, but this was also a man who was given the Spirit of God, and that made all the difference. In 1 Peter 3, in verse 4, in the middle of the sentence, we read, but let it be the hidden person of the heart with the incorruptible ornament of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is very precious in the sight of God. Now, the context is talking to wives. But I think Peter also learned how to control his spirit a little bit and have a gentle and quiet spirit, too. You don't see Peter taking out his sword against God's people as he exercised authority later. You don't see Peter being so impulsive. You see a much different Peter. In verse 8, he said, finally, all of you be of one mind. There is only one source for one mind. Hadn't Peter learned that? Christ had told him at one time, you are not mindful of the things of God. To be of one mind altogether, we must all be mindful of the things of God. We must be mindful of the Spirit of God. Brethren, the longer I live life, the more simple it becomes in so many ways. We must have God's Spirit more effectively, more effectively. That is, any other thing will get in the way. So he said, be of one mind, having compassion for one another. Love as brothers. Be tenderhearted. Be courteous, not returning evil for evil or reviling for reviling, but on the contrary, blessing, knowing that you were called to this. How could Peter write this? Because he had lived it. He had really understood these things. There's no need to cut off ears. You know, this is the way to be. This is the way to be, so that you may inherit a blessing. Peter was writing from experience. And then in verse 18, he said, for Christ also suffered once for sin, the just for the unjust, that he might bring us to God. Christ is always trying to bring us to God through his Spirit. He does that by teaching us, by training us, by leading us, by helping us assimilate the experiences of life, being put to death in the flesh, but made alive by the Spirit. As we come to the day of Pentecost, this is what we have to learn. As it was written in Zechariah 4:6, it's not by might, it's not by power, but by my Spirit. This is by my Spirit. Peter had learned it. He'd walked, talked, ate with for 3.5 years of that closeness to Christ had helped him to see unless I have God's Spirit? What will the human spirit do? All the way, right up to the end, to the time Jesus died, Peter was exercising his spirit. And when the Spirit of God was given, then he saw it. Then he really began to see it. And then God used him. He got out of the way. And how much we need to understand we need the Spirit of God. So, you know, we look at Peter's life. God called Peter. He worked with Peter. He taught him patiently. Peter sometimes failed. Sometimes he passed the test. I wonder if some of the people back then in the early church might have looked at all the times Peter failed and wondered, why did God put him here? I hope they looked at how Peter changed and grew and overcame and yielded to God in a spirit of humility. There's a lot to admire about Peter. Lesser people would have dropped away. Lesser people would have gotten discouraged and given up. Lesser people would have gotten mad. Lesser people would have been offended. But Peter knew he was the Christ, and he hung in there. And in his life, we see a pattern for us. Christ is changing our character, too, by teaching, by example, by test, that he may bring us to God. We're going to face many things in life, but whatever we face, always be asking, what is in this for me to learn, just like Peter? So that we, like him, when we are completely turned to God and return to him and turn to him in every way, he can say, feed my sheep, strengthen the brethren.